Cambridge 105 Radio.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women. We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results.
I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe.
And we produce and present Women Making Waves. In this edition of Women Making Waves, we meet Professor Melody Clark, who is a project leader at British Antarctic Survey, who won the Senior Prize for Outstanding Women in Marine Biological Sciences. Women Making Waves contributor Jan Moore talks to Melody about her work, the Antarctic, and climate change.
Sarah Glover was so shocked by how some women and girls in India were treated that she set up a charity called Born to Be Beautiful. Sarah uses her skills as a beautician to train these women as manicurists so that they have a way of earning a living.
And Kelly Molson tells the story of how she jointly set up a web agency, and when she found that few other women were running agencies, she set out to change that by setting up a network where they could share ideas.
That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves. Linda, Sarah Glover, she's set up this amazing charity called Born to be Beautiful, and she's done a lot of hard work, hasn't she, supplying some skills to the women and ladies in Uganda.
And in India as well.
And in India as well.
Yeah. I thought she was wonderful. Very, very interesting topic. Basically, she discovered that lots of women out there had been forced into prostitution and other kind of slave labour, some in terrible, terrible conditions. And her thinking is that if you train them with a job and train them in doing something, then they won't ever starve. I think that's a great idea.
And it's been a bit of a journey for Sarah, and I love her perseverance. She's done really well, hasn't she? And she's
very
come out.
Very charming, lovely person.
So we're going to be hearing now from Sarah Glover talking to Linda and I.
And then I just thought, do you know what? If you give me a pot of nail varnish and a nail file, I will teach these girls a skill.
What is your perception of beauticians? Lots of us visit them to make our nails look nice. Often we make friends with them and chat to them. They're our confidants. They change the world in a small way. But today we meet a beautician who's changing the world for lots of people. In particular, women who are in desperate need of a skill and a way of making a living. With just a nail file and a pot of polish. Sarah Glover has set up a charity called Born to be Beautiful. Sarah, tell us about why you set up this charity.
I heard a friend of mine speaking about his trip to India where he visited a charity. As part of the visit to the charity, they were showing him the injustices that happen in India. And they took him to this street and he walked down the street and it was a line of brothels. And he said that on that line, part of the brothels were offering young little girls and they were chained to their beds.
That's awful.
It's unbearable, really, isn't it?
It was. And as a mother, as a woman, as anybody would feel, it was a devastating thing for me to hear. And he talked a little bit more, not in too much detail, but he said when he got to the end of that street, it affected him so badly. He was so distressed and distraught that he threw up. And that story actually haunted me for the next couple of years. I asked him, would he take me on a trip? I don't know why I wanted to go and see it. It was a ridiculous thing. I didn't want to see that. I just wanted to, I suppose, get in touch with what they were doing in India and how life really was. Because I, at the time, was living in my perfect little house in Cambridge. I had my two daughters in lovely Cambridge schools. And we cycled to school across the park. And everything was very lovely. And now I'd heard this. I was absolutely broken. I really was broken.
It's strange, isn't it, that some things just strike a chord with you. But often what happens when you hear these things is in time, you kind of start to put them to the back of your mind and you forget about them. But you didn't, did you?
In 2010, so that was 2 years after I'd heard the talk, it still hurt me, but I had put it back to my mind because I didn't know what to do and I didn't know how to make a change. And at 2010, I was training to climb Kilimanjaro. We were raising funds for a girlfriend's charity called Climb for Freedom, and we raised money to have a safe house in London for people who've been trafficked. And I'd just set up my own salon in Cambridge, and I'd doing lots of retraining as a beautician because I'd stopped while I was a mother. I was busy, and he phoned and he said, would you like to come on this trip? And I thought, oh yeah, I'll come. I'll tick the box and I'll raise some money, and didn't really think deeply into it until I got there. And in fact, the first night we were there, we went to a meeting and they were just talking. We were in India, it was very hot, and I can remember they were playing music and the fans were going to keep us cool. And they were telling some stories, and I can remember my heart breaking once again. And it was horrific.
Where did this take you after this trip? What happened?
I suppose after I'd gone to India in 2010 with this guy and the team, they took us to a safe house. A few of us were allowed to go into a safe house. A few girls only were allowed to go, and we were taken into the suburbs, really, of Mumbai. And we saw this safe house of these young women who had been rescued from trafficking. Some of them had been sold as little tiny children into the brothels, and some of them had just sort of been found wandering. So these girls, I saw them there. And again, I had a moment where there was two little girls in front of me. They were 14 and 15, and they were looking down. They wouldn't look me in the eye, and because they were ashamed of what they had done. And I remember standing there feeling absolutely ashamed of what I had done. And I thought, how can I be so preoccupied with my own perfect little life and not be doing anything for the girls across the ocean?
You know. Because you were saying that you had daughters the same age back here. So yeah. It really struck a chord as well, that one, didn't it?
Absolutely. They were the exact same age. So they stood next to each other, the same way my daughters would stand next to each other. And I couldn't reconcile. It didn't make sense.
What were you thinking? How could you help them? So you could see them being very helpless. You knew you had a life at home that was very comfortable. But how are you going to connect with them?
Well, I'm a beautician. And if you see somebody in distress, the first thing you do as a beautician is you go, oh, would you like your nails done? Or, oh, shall I plait your hair? Or shall I brush your hair? Or something like that. Because I don't know, it's something about beauticians. We're very nurturing. We're normally really lovely, kind people. We care. We care for our sisters. We do. That's the way we are.
And the whole point of this charity is to give the women the confidence to go out and earn a living on their own and not be dependent on horrible stories that we're hearing about. You were saying earlier about human trafficking, which yeah. Obviously it's hard to listen to, but I think it would be good if you could just explain why you saw this and why you wanted to move forward.
Yeah, human trafficking is so despicable. I actually won't speak about the stories I heard, and actually I cannot hear the stories now because they're so beyond what you could ever think of. There are women and men who can tell you those stories, and they tell them beautifully, but I cannot tell those stories because I can't manage. But I suppose I was standing looking at these two young women thinking, what can I do to help? We all do. I can raise money, I can do this, I can do that. And then I just thought, do you know what? If you give me a pot of nail varnish and a nail file, I will teach these girls a skill. And I knew that they could sit on their doorstep, they could sit right wherever they were, and they could do somebody's nails and they could get some money for it. And then they could feed themselves. They wouldn't be trapped anymore. They could feed themselves. If they got really good at it, they could feed their kids. They could send their children to school, which some of our women are doing now. They're taking them to the doctor. And some of our women have actually grown and set up their own little businesses.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a simple but brilliant idea, actually.
Thank you. It's grown a little bit. Now we actually give them full kits, which are beautiful. I mean, anyone in the UK doing a beauty training course would love one of our kits. They're worth about between £200 and £300 because we have some great people who send us products, high-end products, and we teach them how to use these products. And then when we leave, we give every single girl a kit, a full kit, where they can do at least 50 manicures or pedicures. People from Canada have sent us these, again, gorgeous uniforms and a certificate, and then they can go.
Sarah, did you have any resistance to it at the beginning? Did you find that the women found it very hard to come to you first?
Yeah, the charities gather the women. So I work with the charity. So I always work with a charity partner. So they gather the girls. They normally are having feeding programs or other programs for little ones. And then they've got these teenage girls or, you know, young women or even the older women of 60. They have these women and they're not quite sure what to do with them. Apart from feed them, they don't know how to employ them because there's no educational, there's no vocational schools. Well, there are, but they're for the elite girls in both India and in Africa. When we gave the certificates at the end of the course, one of the women got down on her knees and bowed her head to me and put her hand up and said, "Thank you for doing that." She said, "You touched us." I'm surprised I haven't cried, actually, which is quite good because normally I cry at that moment because it still gets me. And I thought, do you know what? If I was in her shoes and I was in the gutter with a disease that nobody would touch me and I had become the outcast of the village, I also would be on my knees if somebody came and helped me.
So how does this work? You get these women and you put them on this course. How long is the course, first of all, and who's taking it?
So the course is 2 weeks. It's Monday to Friday, full time, because we're basically taking them from nothing to something. And I want them to be good. You know, I want them to be proud of what they do. I want them to do a very good job. So we teach them anatomy, physiology. They know all the, not all the Latin names, but they do learn the Latin names of the muscles. They learn the Latin names of the nails. They understand care. So the charity, our partner charities, they have some responsibilities. So if they want me to come, their responsibility is to provide me with a suitable training room and to bring the girls and to do the application forms.
And is it an ongoing thing? Are these courses run all the time or is it just when you're out there or how does that work?
At the moment, it's just when I go. I do have some other people who are learning to train. There are the beauticians who are having it, taking their teaching qualification, and they'd like to do it as well. But at the moment, we're quite a small charity, so it's just when I go. Mm-hmm. Although we have trained 104 women so far, which is quite exciting.
You explained earlier that they come away with a beautician box and they have a uniform, and so they become very skilled and they have a style. But it must have been really hard to explain that to them from the beginning, not having anything, and then suddenly walking out of a course looking like you do. How did you get that across? How did you draw them in? I'm fascinated by that.
It's a gradual process, and they have to learn to trust me to start with. They don't even trust me because they're not, trust isn't in their vocab. The trust has been completely beaten out of them, you know, in many ways. And we couldn't possibly show them the full kit on day one. We don't show them anything. The day one, they get a pencil, they get some colours, like 3 or 4 colours, because we, you know, we teach them, they have handouts and they have to colour bits of different parts of the nail in and everything. They get a pencil, they get a pen, they get some colours, they get some handout, and then they get a folder to put their stuff in. And they can't even believe that. Honestly,
that's a huge thing to them.
That's huge, yeah. So that's day one. And then day two, we will teach them hand washing is the first thing. So this is the first real moment, I think, when they get to feel what we're bringing them, because we have bowls that we get there. That's another thing the charity have to provide, their bowls. But we always bring beautiful hand wash because that's what's donated to us. And so everyone gets to wash their hands in hot water. They bring towels as well. We give them each a little towel. So that's the first time when they think, oh my goodness. And we teach them hand washing skills because that is the number one life-saving skill in India and in Uganda.
Now, I get the impression, Sarah, from doing this, you've learnt a hell of a lot since starting this charity. What challenges have you had in producing this amazing charity, Born to be Beautiful?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I have had quite a few challenges. Yeah, I've had loads of challenges. But I suppose I made a choice. When I first thought about helping these girls, I realised that to ask for money constantly and to ask for people to come with me, I'm going to have set up a charity. And so I looked on the Charity Commission website, and I can remember having to read that. It took me 2 months to read that. I used to set myself aside 2 hours a day, and I read the website with a dictionary. I didn't even understand the words. I didn't.
They don't make it easy, really.
They don't, really.
They don't. Yeah. They have simplified it, bless them now. But back, you know, I know it's at 10 years, but I couldn't understand it. And I remember thinking, why would I do this? I'm a beautician. I don't know all this stuff. It was ridiculous to me. So that was a huge challenge. But I do get offered wonderful jobs in London or in Dubai, where the pay is ridiculous. And I'm like, well, I've got to do my charity. you know, so I can't do that. So I have a little job in Cambridge 3 days a week that I work at. Yeah.
I would urge people to look at your website, borntobebeautiful.org. It is really, really good, packed with information. Very, very good. But I mean, to get those skill sets, it costs a fortune, you know, if you're paying for them, marketing and website design and stuff.
I say to my volunteers, rightly or wrongly, you have to get that for free. Whatever it is they want, I say, you have to do that for free. We are not spending our money here in the UK. We are taking our money out to Uganda or to India.
I think that's where the little charities really come into their own, because the money that goes into those little charities actually benefits the end user, let's call them.
Yeah.
It benefits the people who really need it most. And I love that. I love the fact that small charities are very, very sure that every penny is spent in the right way.
Well, today as well, if somebody gives me a £20 note, I can take a photo of it with my iPhone and I can show them the journey that £20 note goes, you know, and it gets to them. And the other thing is great is I take the kits. We take the kits in our suitcases. So the team come together before we go on a course and I go, we have got 25 kits to take with us, plus uniforms, plus pens and pencils, plus my teaching materials, which I have to carry anyway. We have to get them through our suitcases. So you pack light, everyone has to pack light, and they have to have part of the kit with us. So we take it and we use it, we teach with it, and then we give it to them. So the stuff people give is getting, and we can video it, and we do video it.
Yeah. So no matter how small or large a charity is, you still got to run the charity. So in many ways, it is like a business, isn't it? So you've had to become, well, you probably were very organised. You sound very organised anyway, but you've had to be very on it because you've got quite a few helping in your charity. And has that journey been quite a sort of a learning curve for you?
It's a huge learning curve. I constantly feel that I fall short across the board, actually, in every area. Because I think as well, when you're running a charity, you always see the need. There's always so much need. And you think, oh, gosh, I need to get bigger. I need to do better. I need to have better. You know, I need to be better as a woman. And yeah, I do feel that quite a lot.
That's interesting. As a woman. Why do you say as a woman as opposed to a man?
I suppose because I am a woman. I don't know. I just feel like, I don't know. Why would I say that?
You don't feel that imposter syndrome. Please don't tell me you feel the imposter
syndrome.
No,
I don't actually. No. Thank goodness, because I know I've got probably loads of other syndromes, but not that one.
Tell us about the trips, because you don't go on your own usually, do you? You take other people with you. Tell us about how you find them and what they do when you go out there.
The people who I find actually find me, which is fantastic. I have people email me saying, I've heard what you do, could I come on a trip? And I normally say yes, but there is quite a process you have to go through. It's very, you know, you wouldn't know you were going through the process, but you are going through a process. It's cost about £2,000 to take somebody with me to Uganda because, say, for instance, in Uganda, we travel to Entebbe, which is the main airport there. But then we have an 8-hour journey. So we have to have a driver and we have to then stop over sometimes. And we always stay in good hotels. You know, if we stay in the flea bitten hotels, you know, they won't have any fire regulations. You know, you get sick from the food. When I went to India, it was when there were bombs going off. When I went to Uganda, there was, you know, almost a coup years ago when they had that uprising. You have to be somewhere safe. You have to be somewhere where something kicks off, which it can do instantly, especially when you're not up to speed with what's going on in the country or, you know, something happens. You have to be somewhere where if something happens, you will be looked after. You won't be left. So we always stay in a good hotel that has good security and that costs. And we don't actually make any profit out of that whatsoever. That is the cost. And so you have to be prepared to pay that. And then when you come, you'd come and you journey with us. It's often a very big shock for that person. So there's normally about 4 or 5 of us who go on a trip, a 2-week trip. You stay for 2 weeks. I will have already spoken to you about what it is. Most people have something in their mind they want to bring. We had a lawyer, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, she was head of Barclays, and now she's working advising the government. And because we bring the people who come are such high calibre, they always have something fantastic. So I let them teach that sort of in the down times. You know, you don't just teach beauty. We have to teach behaviour. We have to teach trust. We have to teach honesty. They get their first lesson in honesty is on day one, when that night I give them everyone a polish to take home with them. And I say, paint your nails, paint your mum's nails, your auntie's nails, your daughter's nails, and then bring that polish back tomorrow. And if you can imagine when you have nothing, absolutely nothing, no, a bare floor, a bare walls, bringing that polish back is a really tricky thing for them to do. Yeah.
And do you find that sometimes happens?
Yep, some of the girls do. And we count them in and we count them out. And they wrestle with bringing it back because it's like... Yeah, because that's they don't know what they're going to get. They don't know they're going to get that entire kit. They have no idea. As far as they're concerned, they had a piece of paper and a pencil, which we also take in with us because we don't let them take it away because it might never come back. So they don't know what's going to happen. Yeah.
If you were able to advise anyone setting up a charity, what have you learned that you would pass on to somebody else doing something very similar to you?
I would say to them to ask people who've gone before them and say, what would be the foundation stones that you would use? You know, somebody, when I asked that question, somebody said to me, make sure you always work with local partners. So you don't just go in and do something and then gone forever. And somebody else said, make it self-sustaining. You know, make it into something so you don't constantly have to raise money. You know, I had some incredible advice. I would say go to people who've gone before you and listen to what they have to say.
Sarah, it's great to hear what you're doing, and it's a really commendable thing. It's always good to keep things going. And I know you said earlier that you want people to come and visit you and see what you do and if they are keen to help you.
Yeah, I think most people love, I mean, you don't, the best feeling you can ever have is when you help somebody, isn't it? You do feel good about yourself, there's no doubt about it. And I know there's some incredibly well-skilled people here in Cambridge. I am a beautician, you know, who set up a charity because I can paint nails. So there's all the skills that we need in a business and running a charity that I either have to learn, which takes a while, or I have to, somebody else has to come and do it. So if anybody would love to come and just bring who they are, basically, to the table, we would love to have it, because I'd like to build this charity into something that was strong and stable and that self-sustaining.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you. It really has, Sarah. Thank Glover. I think for, you know, the charity Born to be Beautiful is exceptional, and you've worked very, very hard. You can tell you've worked hard in this, and we wish you all the very best.
Yes, we do. It's been great.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a complete pleasure being here. Thank you.
And that was Sarah Glover talking to Susie Thorpe and me, Linda Ness.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Isn't it a small world, really? Here in Women Making Waves, sometimes you can join the dots up between the guests that we have. And this guest that we have coming up next mentions in her interview one of our previous guests, the previous guest being Morgan Sieg. Now, we had her in and she was talking about the Antarctic and women in the Antarctic, whereas the guest that we're having today is Professor Melody Clark. She also talks about the Antarctic. They know each other.
Of course, it is Cambridge and it's a small world in that sense, but it's equally interesting talking to these women individually because they all have something to give. And I loved it. And the whole interview, I listened to it and it was just fantastic. And Jan, our contributor, has done a great job with this one, hasn't she?
Yes, she has indeed. And they also mentioned climate change, very topical again. Another topic that comes up again and again at the moment.
So we'll be listening now to Professor Melody Clark talking to our contributor, Jan Moore.
My work really has two aspects. So it's looking at how Antarctic marine invertebrates have adapted to life in the freezing ocean. And on the other hand, it's obviously looking at their responses to change, so how they respond to 1 or 2 degrees of warming.
I recently caught up with Professor Melody Clark, who's an individual merit promotion scientist and project leader at British Antarctic Survey. My friend Mel won the Senior Prize for Outstanding Women in Marine Biological Sciences a few years back, but I've always wondered what she actually does day to day, so I started by asking her.
Well, as a project leader, I'm responsible for leading the science and developing science projects. So, unfortunately, that does involve quite a lot of administration. But, you know, the great thing is I get to supervise project students and also get involved in the research as well. So my work really has two aspects. So it's looking at how Antarctic marine invertebrates have adapted to life in the freezing ocean, because basically they live more or less permanently at 0 degrees. And we know some very obvious adaptations, such as antifreeze in fish, but we don't really know a lot about the subtle changes they've made to their genes to enable them to function effectively at 0 degrees. And on the other hand, it's obviously looking at their responses to change, so how they respond to 1 or 2 degrees of warming. Are they still okay? They look fine, but are they really? And that's where, as a molecular biologist, the technique really comes in, because you start to look at what's happening in their cells. Is their immune system compromised? Is their reproduction affected by this? And you can only really tell that by looking at the genes that they produce in response to slightly warmer temperatures.
Right. So some of that will be work that you'll actually do here in Cambridge on the site in Bass. But actually some of that then must be in the field in the very cold south.
Yes, some of it is, because some of the animals we can't keep them long term, and it takes a long time for the animals to come back, because they have to come back on the ship, so it can take 2-3 months depending on if the ship takes a slight detour, at which point they're in aquarium tanks and artificial aquariums, so that's not so good in terms of trying to understand their reactions. Mm. So yes, I do go down to the Antarctic, and I went down in January for my 7th trip.
Gosh. And when you go, how long are you there for?
It does vary, but about 2 months,
right,
normally, of which a week is travel, basically.
Yeah. Because this is for women making waves, it's really interesting to find out, are there greater challenges being a woman being in that environment? Because it's quite a sort of, you're cut off from everybody else, you're working very closely with other scientists.
I personally haven't found it a challenge at all, because you're part of a team and you just do your job and everybody just gets on with it and it's terribly professional and supportive. And yes, you are thousands of miles away, but these days we're much more in contact with the UK. You know, there's telephone calls. In fact, the extension number in the Bonn Lab, where I work, is actually an extension to a Cambridge number.
That's strange.
Which is all a bit strange, really.
Very strange indeed.
And, you know, there's internet. So you're not nearly as disconnected as you were in the past, where they used to send the men off for months on end,
absolutely,
with just the telex machine.
So, and have you noticed then in your scientific work that actually there's maybe more women involved in your branch of science now than there were? Or perhaps it's always been fairly equal?
No. Up until about the 1980s, women were not allowed to go to the Antarctic.
Oh, really?
With the British Antarctic Survey.
Gosh.
Full stop. And the first British woman, Janet Thompson, went to the Antarctic in 1983. And Liz Morris was the first woman to do deep field work in 87, 88. So it's relatively recent, I guess,
yes,
depending on how old you are.
Yes, I'm not asking.
No. But now it's really, really changed. And Bass, on the science side and science support side, it's actually 40% women, which is a big change from previously. And they know it's still an issue. They still have to improve. And they've put measures in to try and encourage women through the career path. Certainly, when you start with PhD students or first career postdocs, they are 50-50.
Right.
Male, female. But there's the kind of leaky pipe, I think it's called, that as you get higher up the ranks, the number of women do decrease quite significantly.
Mm. Yes.
And that is still an issue. But, you know, everybody knows it's an issue and they're working towards improving that.
And that's an issue in so many professions.
Exactly.
For all the reasons that we understand. Well, that's really interesting. I had no idea that it's relatively recently that people can actually go.
Yes, I mean, women could work for the British Antarctic Survey,
yes,
but they just absolutely weren't allowed to go to the Antarctic.
Gosh, that's amazing. Now, recently, you've been to the Hay Festival, but you weren't there to read the books. What were you doing at the Hay Festival?
Well, they have an association with the University of Cambridge, the Hay Festival does.
Oh, right.
And so Cambridge University put on a certain number of events each year. And this year, one of the events was a discussion panel, Female Voices and Climate Change, and I was invited to be part of that discussion panel.
How did that all go?
Yes, it actually went really well. It was really interesting to do. It's sometimes quite a challenge doing different things like that, because I was just given 6 minutes to talk. So I had to do, I was told 3 minutes on your science and 3 minutes on the issues of science communication. So it does actually take quite a lot of preparation work and thought and practice to try and just cram everything into such a short space of time.
Yes.
And then, of course, you get questions from the audience, from the chair that, you know, you have no control over and you have no idea what they might ask you.
So were the other panellists scientists then?
Yes, they were. So Morgan is doing a PhD in gender science in Antarctic science. Chandrika Nath, who's the executive director of the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research, is a former glaciologist and she's now moved back into science. She was a science advisor for the UK government. And Ragnhild is just finished a PhD and she's at the Scott Poland. She was a social anthropologist. So it's a big mix, but the idea was to get a panel of women talking about climate science.
Yes. And did you get really interesting questions from the audience then?
Yes, we did. I think a lot of people were intrigued about, as you were, about the fact that women weren't allowed to go to the Antarctic.
Yes.
And yeah, people were fascinated by that because you don't really think about that, because these days on the media, you just get a transmission from the Antarctic. It's men, women, you know, there isn't the distinction like there used to be in the old days, really.
Yes. And I think it's the fascination with the type of work that you're doing, though, apart from the fact that obviously this is a relatively new experience for women from the 1980s, but the impact of the work that you're doing in terms of climate change, when it's very much in the news, particularly over the last few days with the president here. I mean, I didn't know that I was going to get that in, but I seem to have done. But, you know, climate change is on our lips and in our ears all the time at the moment. So it's such important work. And I think, as you say, to be able to link that with what's actually physically going on in the South is so important.
Yes, absolutely. And what happens in the Antarctic does affect our weather and what actually happens here. But it was quite interesting because before I went to the Hay Festival, I was talking to our comms group and saying, you know, I need to talk about communication. I've got 3 minutes. And they're saying, well, one thing you should mention is fatigue, news fatigue. People do get fed up of hearing about things.
Absolutely.
That, even though we have this amazing scenery, fantastic animals, the cute, cuddly stuff, whatever, that people love to see, you can't stick that on the news every single week. People get tired about it. So you have to kind of feed things in, work out what the most important stories are, what your points are, to try and stop that fatigue, really, which is, you know, it's a shame, but...
Yes, I hadn't thought about it like that. I think we've linked it so much with some particular personalities that we have forgotten the reality of what's going on and the actual impact of those tiny, small creatures and organisms that are going to impact on what happens here.
Absolutely, and it's the first time I'd really thought about that because, you know, in the past I've been to the comms group and said, oh, I've got this paper published in this fantastic journal, you know, can we do a press story? And they kind of go, we're a bit busy this week. And you kind of go, oh, not again, because, you know, they've got some fantastic logistics story about, you know, the Thwaites Glacier and people out digging snow with these amazingly big machines and small sea urchins just don't cut the ice.
They don't.
No competition, I'm afraid.
But it is it's such an important aspect, isn't it? And I think, as you say, it is amazing that here we are feeling fatigue about finding out about the basis of climate change is a little worrying, I think. So what next for you? I mean, have you, in terms of it's following your projects and monitoring your students, is that the way it works next?
Yes, really. It's just developing science ideas, trying to bring in more funding, and, you know, that's getting more difficult these days, it has to be said, with the B word.
Yes.
Because we are, you know, quite reliant on European funding. So that is a big worry, particularly, I'm sure, you know, in Cambridge. I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people. So, yeah, that's it. I mean, I do also do other work that isn't necessarily Antarctic related. So I am involved, and actually, in actual fact, I led a project looking at how mollusks produce shells.
Oh, right.
So we know there's been a lot of talk about ocean acidification and the fact that animals with heavily calcified skeletons are vulnerable because the more acidic waters will dissolve their shells. And we've got some clams in the Antarctic, which are actually quite big, and they keep getting bashed by icebergs. They repair quite easily. But the question we had was, well, presumably they're quite vulnerable, but we don't really know how they make their shells in the first place, therefore it's difficult to work out how they'll respond to climate change, particularly ocean acidification. And so I took that project, which was actually a PhD student's project, and wrote a European project to develop that and look at different aspects of how mollusks produce shells in commercial shellfish species, so blue mussels, clams, scallops, and oysters, which was incredibly successful. And it has to be said, great fun, because you can actually eat what you study for a change.
I didn't think you were going to say that, but what a thought. Well, if you grow these mussels on these ropes and things, something's got to happen.
Exactly, and once you've sampled a tiny piece of tissue, there is some left, which, you know, would be wasteful just to throw away. It has to be said.
It can't be right.
No.
I've now got this wonderful image of that's what you're doing at Bass, is just growing mussels and eating them all day.
Unfortunately, the project's finished, but, you know, I keep trying to finding to continue that, because I think it's a fascinating area.
Yeah.
And there's so much still to learn about how these animals actually function day to day.
Yes.
Because we know that for a few model organisms like humans, mice, rats, fruit flies. But in the natural environment, we actually know very little about how animals function day to day and how that's affected by climate change.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, that we don't do that. And as you say, it all comes back to this fatigue and our, you know, we know a lot about jungles, we know a lot about furry animals, but actually our whole world is dependent on all of those tiny things that are going on underneath the waves.
To be honest, if you spoke to a microbiologist, they would claim that it's all down to the bacteria, because they take up the biggest biomass on the planet.
Yeah, so
they would argue, I'm probably wasting my time as well. But it is the microscopic stuff that's important, but that feeds up through the food chain.
Absolutely.
And we have to understand the food chain and the food web.
Yes.
As to how our oceans will fare in the future.
Wow. Gosh, that's a big topic to end on. It's so important. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today. When do you go south next, then?
I honestly don't know at the moment. It really does depend on funding.
Yes.
And I don't go that often.
Yeah.
But hopefully I'll manage to go again in the future, because it's an absolutely stunning place to go. Rothera Research Base, where I work, is an amazing place. The scenery is stunning. So I'd kind of like to go back. Thank you.
And thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
And that was Women Making Waves contributor Jan Moore talking to Professor Melody Clark.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Isn't it great when you meet people who've started their own businesses? I love hearing those stories, you know, Susie, of how people have started their own businesses and what's happened and how they got going. And this is the case in this interview. It's Kelly Molson, who started a web agency called Rubber Cheese. Isn't that a great name?
It's a great name, isn't it? You would never think of calling an agency Rubber Cheese. It just stands out, and clever her.
She came in and she talked about how she got going, and she talked about how surprised she was that there were so few women. I think it was 27%, she said, of UK agency owners were women.
She was very shocked about that. But anyway, I don't want to give too much away, but it was a really interesting story. And I liked it because she was quite young when she started this agency. Mm-hmm. Boy, that is brave.
Yeah, 24.
24. I don't know what I was doing at 24. You remember what you were doing at 24?
I do remember that was my favourite year, actually.
Oh, was it?
I didn't start an agency, sadly. I wish
no.
I had.
Oh, she sounds good. Anyway, enjoy this one with Kelly Molson talking to, of course, Linda.
I was quite surprised to find out that of around 400 or 500 agencies that were surveyed, only 27% of those agencies in the UK were owned by women. And that really shocked me more than anything.
We talk a lot on Women Making Waves about the shortage of women working in technology and in STEM subjects generally. So it's good to hear about people who actively work to get more women into tech. Kelly Molson is Managing Director of web design agency Rubber Cheese, and she runs initiatives to support women agency owners, such as Mob Happy, a peer-to-peer group which supports and inspires up-and-coming leaders. Kelly, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. What is your background and how did you get into tech?
Wow. Well, I actually took a more traditional route than a tech route. I remember being at school and doing relatively well in my GCSEs and being told that I should do A-level art and A-level English and A-level German. And I thought, what job am I going to get if I do them? You know, that I don't know what am I going to be? And I went off and I found a BTEC National Diploma in Graphic Design. So I went to the local college and I enrolled there and loved it, absolutely loved it. I've always been very artistic and that for me seemed like the road to go down where I would be employable about and be artistic at the same time. And I worked in various companies. I worked as a brand designer, I worked as a packaging designer. And then eventually in my last proper job, I worked at an e-commerce company. It was very, very early days of the e-commerce kind of bubble. And I learned how to design for the web. So that was how I got into designing for websites and technology. And that was it. I was completely and utterly hooked.
Because there's bits of programming involved in that as well. Presumably you're working in HTML and things like that.
No. No. I'd love to say that. Well, I think that's one of the things that I talk about is that I think a lot of women, a lot of young students think that to be in technology, you have to be a coder or you have to be a developer. But I manage a team of developers. So where I worked, we always had a designer and a developer working together. And back then they were very separate things. Whereas now, if you're a web designer, you design and you build and you work in HTML or CSS and JavaScript, etc. But back then it was very separate. And that's just how it was for me. So no, I am in technology. I'm just not a coder.
That's all right, though.
And totally fine.
And what happened then? You decided to set up your own company.
I did, yes. I was 24, probably slightly foolish.
24 when you started your own company?
24, wow. Yes. Yes, like I said, young and slightly foolish. Do you know what? I just think I'd got to the point in my career where I think I'd just made some wrong choices about where I wanted to be and I just didn't know what I wanted to do. So essentially, myself and a good friend that I'd met working at the company decided we were going to kind of freelance for a year and see what happened. But we did it under the name of Rubber Cheese. So two
That's
of us went
name.
Out. Thank you. Thank you. It does get a lot of attention. So we went out and we found work and we kind of pooled our resources and we were really lucky. Within a couple of, well, I want to say a couple of weeks really, I sent out an email to all of the connections that I had, which at that point was not very many, you know, nearly 16 years ago. And a friend that I'd recently connected with from school on Friends Reunited, that's how old this is,
Friends Reunited,
retro. He got in touch and said, look, I'm working for an architects firm. We're pitching for some work for Tesco's, but we need a design team to come in and partner up with us. Would you be interested? So we said, yeah, definitely. And long story short, we were very lucky to have kind of a 2-year contract with that organisation. And within a couple of months of setting up our own company, be kind of in quite high profile design meetings at Tesco's headquarters and working with them. And it was just incredible.
That is amazing, actually. So that was starting from nothing into a job I would imagine that a lot of design companies would really be interested in going after.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie, it wasn't super glamorous work, but it was brilliant to be involved in such a great organisation and to be in those kind of meetings was a really good learning curve for us. We'd obviously had quite a lot of client, you know, liaison at our last roles, but that was really kind of throwing you in at the deep end. And fantastic, you know, 2 years of that solid contract allowed us to then kind of figure out what we wanted to do and who we worked best with. And the company just sort of grew organically. So Paul and I did that for about 5 years. And then we got to the point of working stupid hours and knowing that we needed to hire, but then on the cusp of winning a really big contract. So we took the risk and took on our first team member. And then it's been 16 years now and we're a team of 7. We've got developers, designers and work with some incredible clients. So we're really, really lucky. A lot of the work we do is in the visitor attraction world or food and drink. So we work with Pernod Ricard. We work with their brands like the Glenlivet or Beefeater Gin. And we work with organisations like Eureka, the National Children's Museum. So clients all over the country, and as in Perno, is a global organisation as well, so extremely lucky.
But it sounds like you hadn't really thought all that much about it when you started. You started it,
But you didn't have a huge plan at the time, did you? Or did you?
No, no plan.
But sometimes that's the way to do it. If you overthink it, you don't do it because it's terrifying.
Yeah, I agree. When we first started up, if I'd have thought this is where we were going to end up, I would have been too scared to actually do it.
Yeah.
I mean, we did set goals. I think quite early on, even within the first year, we kind of knew that we wanted to be an agency. We knew we wanted a team and we knew we wanted to grow. But we did do that very organically and we did it in our own time. So it was really manageable. And I think that gave us a resilience that you know, we built that resilience over time rather than rushing into a huge growth plan.
Do you have ambitions to become really big, to employ 50 people or 100?
We have growth plans, but I never really wanted to be a 50, 60 organisation agency. I feel like you lose a lot of that personal touch at mm-hmm. that point. Mm-hmm. So we do have growth plans, but I think we're probably capping at about 15 or 20.
And at some point, did you notice that there were mainly men that you're employing, or did that not really happen to you? Have you had a good mix?
Well, interestingly, no. Actually, we were always kind of 80-20 female, male. We had two brilliant women designers who worked with us for a number of years. So actually, it's only been recently where that has shifted the other way around. And it's probably, I guess there's a few reasons. I think we do a lot more development work now than we did. Back then, we were more traditionally kind of a graphic design agency that did some web. And we've really struggled to hire female developers.
And at the end of the day, you've got to take the best people for the job, not defined by their sex. I mean,
absolutely.
That would be silly.
Absolutely. We hire the best people mm-hmm. for that role. Absolutely. But we would still love it if more women actually yes. applied for some of the developer roles. And that doesn't seem to happen so much. And there's probably a few different reasons for that. But what I was more interested in over the last few years is how few women agency owners I actually knew. I was quite surprised to find out that of around 400 or 500 agencies that were surveyed, only 27% of those agencies in the UK were owned by women. And that really shocked me more than anything.
So many women that I've spoken to who have businesses, when we were talking to people on this programme, so many of them have started at the kitchen table. And that is the way sometimes to do it, because there's not a big fear. You just do what you're doing. You enjoy what you're doing. And if it grows, it grows. And sometimes, like you, you're almost forced to grow.
Yes, we got to the point where we had to hire. I mean, we wanted to, but we had to hire.
Yeah.
We took on bigger clients. The work was getting more and more involved. If I'm honest, we got to the point where I needed to step back from being a designer as well. And that's what I did. We brought in a designer who essentially took my design work from me. And then I could look at
how
growing
did you feel
the
about that?
Company.
How did you feel about handing that over to someone else?
I felt really resentful. really
I hope
resentful.
I should say that because I would.
It's funny. I didn't feel resentful towards the designer. She was fantastic. She was a much better designer than I ever was. My business partner and I have talked about this quite a lot, but I actually felt resentful of him because he was in a creative director role. So he still got to do what I saw as the real fun bit of the job. And I was suddenly thrown into having to learn about spreadsheets and pipeline and profit and loss. And God, that was dry. Really dry.
So you started up by agencies. When you talk about agencies, you mean the plethora of agencies, don't you? Not just design agencies?
Yes, no, not just design agencies. We talk to all kinds of agencies. So we're a web development agency. We know graphic design agencies. We know content marketing agencies, digital agencies. There's a whole plethora, as you say.
Mm-hmm. So you started up a kind of network of women agencies,
yes.
People that owned agencies that were women. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
But were people a bit suspicious of that? Because some of them will be your competitors. And how open are they when they come along to events and talk about their business?
Do you know what? Things have changed so drastically over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. When we first set up in business, you could not get another agency to talk to you for love nor money. It was very, very competitive, highly competitive, especially in localised areas like Cambridge or in Hertfordshire where we were based. And things are so different now. There are some fantastic organisations, one of which is the Agency Collective, which we're members of, which is a London-based organisation. They run events in Edinburgh and Bristol, up and down the country, but it brings together agency owners and everybody is supportive and open because most of the time you have the same challenges and they're around how to get new business, hiring and firing, growing your organisation, profit mm-hmm. and cash flow. And if you can help each other with those challenges, most agencies are quite niche now as well. So you're not competing as much as you used to be. You know, people want to use specialists for specialist roles. So it is a lot more open. So I think there wasn't as much suspicion about a network as there would have been in the past. But I think really for me, it was just that surprise of finding out about this low percentage of agency owners being women.
Yeah.
So there's an organisation called The Wow Company. They're a specialist accountancy firm for agency owners. And every year they run a bench press report, which surveys agency owners up and down the country. And that's initially how I found out about this 27% and was slightly enraged by it. But then I took it upon myself and I thought, well, who do you know in your network that's another agency owner, a women agency owner? And I thought, well, I probably know about three or four. So if I don't know them, why should anybody else? And, yeah. and that's ridiculous.
And how did you get that off the ground then? Did you publicise it through social media or how did you do it?
Well, it started initially with an interview series that I ran. So I set out to speak to other women agency owners and find out what they thought about the 27% and what their startup story had been, why they set up their agency, how they did it. I think I spoke to and interviewed around 35 to 40 women on a blog, kellymolson.co.uk. And all of their stories and all of the information I got from them was so inspiring. A lot of women had set up their agencies when they'd been on maternity leave or they'd been made redundant. And there was a real kind of sense of spirit about this is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it started. And then over time, I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could bring these women together and that actually they could support not only each other, but actually then inspire other women that would like to take that step into running an agency. There's a lot of freelancers out there that are doing their thing, but they don't know how to do the next step if they want to employ someone or they want to start to grow. So that was why Mob Happy was set up.
And what form do your meetings take? Are they actual virtual meetings or do you all get together in the one spot?
No, physical meetings.
They're physical meetings.
Yes. So initially I ran a mastermind group. So we would get 6 to 8 women together. And each of the women would be able to bring something that they needed support with at that point. It might be an issue or a challenge they had. It might be they were looking to, I don't know, find a new project management system. What could we mm-hmm. share about the ones that we use? And they've been brilliant. They're extremely supportive. I have learned an immense amount from the agency owners that have come along, whether they've been in business for 10 years or 1 year
mm-hmm.
and vice versa. And that's been brilliant. They've run in London for a while and actually they now just continue to run in Cambridge because I took a little bit too much on. but I also then started to get a lot of questions and requests from freelancers to say, we don't know how to do this. You know, we want to grow an agency, but we don't know where to find out how to do that. And there wasn't as much support for them. There's lots of brilliant freelancer communities out there. But that thing seemed to be missing. So I set up the Mob Happy Meetup, which is a free meetup, meets 4 times a year at the brilliant Bradfield Centre. And I bring together a panel every time of different agency owners and we talk about different topics. So we talk about how to take on your first team member, you know, how to hire, what do you have to think about? We talk about finding bigger business, you know, should you look at niching? The last one that we ran was talking around pricing, you know, how do you price yourself effectively?
Yeah, good question.
So, yeah, that's what I do.
That sounds really, really good. And I'll bet you the networking that these people do when they're there as well, when they've got downtime, when you're not presenting and they're just sitting chatting with each other, that's probably invaluable as well.
It really is. I mean, I've made brilliant contacts at the events, people that we now collaborate with and work with. So, yeah, for finding suppliers and finding people that you can partner with, or maybe you might even come along and find your next business partner. Who knows?
Yes. No, absolutely true. Do you have any plans to expand this? Or you don't have time, do you? You should really be focusing on your business.
I took a lot on. Well, I think, so I was running them every month, but one in London and one in Cambridge. And actually, earlier this year, I took the decision to close down the London one because I have my own organisation to run as well. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I was being a little bit overstretched. I would love to see Mob Happy expand into other places. If anyone would love to run an event, that would be a brilliant thing. But for now, I'm quite happy focusing and keeping them local in Cambridge.
And would that just be agencies? Or can you see yourself branching out and maybe having Mob Happy for women in IT, Mob Happy for, you know, other types of groups?
Maybe. I have to say, I haven't thought too much about the expansion just because the agency world is what I know and it's what I know best and it's where I feel I can deliver the most value. But again, I'd be really open to talking to people if they would be interested in taking that on and expanding it into different sectors, because I think the Mastermind platform can work brilliantly for that.
So let's hope that we can encourage some more women to be agency owners and into tech in general as well.
I hope so. Well, one of the things that we're actually doing next week is Mob Happy Events, the masterminds, they all run as not-for-profit. So all of the profits are invested back into initiatives that help to educate young women and students into how they could get into these kind of careers. And like we talked earlier about technology and me not being a coder, I think there are a lot of people out there that assume that you need to be very technical to be a woman in tech, which is not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. So next week, collaborating with Form the Future, we're actually running an enterprise day in a primary school where a number of the women that come along to the Mob Happy events are coming in, and we're going to see what the students can do and come up with ideas as to how we can inspire them a bit more to come into these topics. So I'm really looking forward to running that.
Oh, that sounds like an excellent idea. I love that idea.
Thank you.
Well done in what you're doing, because it sounds amazing. I think pulling people together is always such a great, great thing. Kelly Molson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Kelly Molson talking to Linda Ness. That's all we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Professor Melody Clark, Sarah Glover and Kelly Molson, and of course to our contributor, Jan Moore.
If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her. You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.